It was the costliest natural disaster in the history of the world, according to the World Bank. The catastrophic earthquake and tsunami that hit Japan in 2011, killing nearly 16,000 people. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we'll hear from a young Japanese man who spent the summer in Des Moines talking about the challenges Japan has faced and thanking Americans for their support. Then Mary McCarthy of Drake University will talk about how the disaster has changed U.S.-Japanese relations and about President Obama's pivot to Asia. In the second half hour, Chris Merrill of the University of Iowa's International Writing Program will tell us about writers from around the world converging on Iowa in the coming weeks. That's all coming up after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The World Bank says it was the costliest natural disaster in the history of the world. It's been over 2 years since a catastrophic earthquake and tsunami hit Japan, killing nearly 16,000 people and triggering a nuclear disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi power plant. In just a moment, we'll talk with Mary McCarthy of Drake University about how that disaster has changed U.S.-Japanese relations. But before we focus on relations between countries, let's look at relations between people in this context. Daisuke Ogata is a Kizuna Fellow for the U.S. Center for Citizen Diplomacy's Japan Center Program. He's been living in Des Moines for the past few months as part of the Kizuna's exchange program. Daisuke is a university student in Tokyo. He grew up in Fukushima City, and that's an area heavily impacted by the 2011 disaster. Daisuke Ogata is in our Des Moines studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Now, it's been over 2 years since that day, the day the disaster started. Can you tell us where you were on that day and what happened?
So I was in a different country to study English, but I was watching the moment of the disaster happening 2 years ago. A lot of problems happening on my prefecture.
So it happened, the area that was impacted was the city where you grew up, but on the day it happened, you were somewhere else.
I was in Philippines to study English.
And what did you find when you returned to the city you grew up, Fukushima City?
We were not sure about what's going on because of the explosion of a nuclear power plant.
An earthquake and a tsunami, they are bad enough, but it was this... Was it this big question mark about what would happen at the power plant that was most worrying to people?
Currently, nearly 15,000 people used to live in near the nuclear power plant evacuating. They're living in a temporary house currently. In addition to this, it's absolutely heavy to raise the children. The place has very high radiation. It's very dangerous. Now our city is trying to recover or rebuild from the disaster. So a lot of people are trying to work for reconstruction works and also trying to get rid of the contaminated soil from the ground.
Now, you've been spending the last few months in Des Moines. Soon you'll be leaving Des Moines and eventually getting back to Japan. You're mm-hmm. a Kizuna Fellow for the U.S. Center for Citizen Diplomacy's Japan Center mm-hmm. program. What is your mission in coming to the United States, in spending these months in Des Moines?
One is to promote understanding of recovery and reconstruction work. Two is deepen our Kizuna. The Kizuna means in Japanese a bond or a friendship. Mm. So we want to deepen our Kizuna between United States and Japan because the United States gave us a lot of support. So we want to say thank you.
You spent the summer in Des Moines. How would you compare Des Moines to where you grew up or where you've lived in Japan?
Des Moines is like my hometown.
Really?
I grew up. Yeah. It's my hometown is very famous for agriculture. Des Moines people are also engaged in agriculture. Yeah.
What have you found that you've enjoyed and discovered in Des Moines that you didn't know about?
The kitchen in the U.S. it's pretty big compared to Japan. So I love to cook in the States.
What have you been cooking here in Des Moines?
I sometimes love to cook pasta and pizza.
Okay, Daisuke Ogata, Kizuna Fellow for the U.S. Center for Citizen Diplomacy's Japan Center Program. Thank you so much for coming into our studio and sharing a few of your thoughts, Daisuke.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And now we want to talk a little more in depth about the relationship between Japan and the United States. Joining me now, Mary McCarthy, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at Drake University in Des Moines. She specializes in Japanese foreign policy. Mary McCarthy, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we want to talk about a number of things that have to do with U.S.-Japanese relations in the next few minutes, but let's talk about a name that many people will recognize. The U.S. is about to get a new ambassador to Japan. Who is that?
Carolyn Kennedy.
She's been appointed by President Obama. Awaiting confirmation, what's holding it up?
It's just the normal nomination process. There had been rumors that she was one of several candidates that the Obama administration might nominate. And over the past few months, it became clear that not only was she the front runner, but she was going to be the ambassador designate, which mm-hmm. she is today.
Mm-hmm. Why was she selected for this post?
There are many ideas about why. Obviously, she has one of the most famous names in American politics. She's a Kennedy. She has followed politics, foreign policy throughout her life. But yet there were also many critics, those who asked that very question and couldn't find an answer. Why? Is it a political decision? Is it a decision that will be good for U.S.-Japan relations or not? Is it just because she's a celebrity and will be a big name? But speaking to Japan experts who know Carolyn Kennedy and are familiar with her work in politics, with her interests, her background, it seems that many are not questioning it and mm-hmm. instead are saying she's a good choice.
Does she have any special expertise in Asia or Japan?
Not at all. But she has expressed not only a desire but a commitment to learn more about Japan, to learn more about Asia. And many say she will be highly welcomed by the Japanese, who will take very well to her personality and to that commitment and interest and help her to learn mm-hmm. about Japan and the Japanese.
Earlier in the program, we talked about the earthquake in 2011 mm-hmm. in Japan. Almost 16,000 people died in that earthquake and the following tsunami that hit Japan.
Yes.
The World Bank said it was the costliest natural disaster in the history of the world. Mm-hmm. And according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the fourth largest earthquake on record. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about how that earthquake and tsunami changed the relationship of the U.S. to Japan.
I believe that it reinforced the importance of the relationship for the Japanese people as well as the Japanese government. One of the operations that was extremely influential and continues to be so today is Operation Tomodachi. Tomodachi means friend in Japanese. And this was an operation that was run by the U.S. military as well as U.S. nonprofits, taking a tremendous role in helping with the early rescue efforts till today, helping with rebuilding lives, giving opportunities to young people particularly who lost almost everything in this tragedy.
Now, Japan has been struggling for some time with its economy under its Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, his approach to reviving the economy is called, I believe, if I'm getting this correctly, Abenomics?
Yes, it has been dubbed Abenomics.
What is it?
Abenomics is an idea of really reforming, restructuring the Japanese economy for the 21st century, for moving forward, making the Japanese economy more competitive globally.
What has been the problem with the Japanese economy? Give us the state of the economy right now.
The Japanese economy has faced what we call an L-shaped recession since really the 1990s. It hit bottom in the early 2000s and then seemed to be doing well, or better, I should say, really based on exports. And so the early recovery in the early to mid-2000s was based on export. As we know, the problem with basing your economy on exports is if something happens like the global recession of 2008. Mm-hmm. And so when Japan faced that recession, it really plunged it back into the doldrums.
Mm-hmm. I know one of the driving forces when the economy in Japan was really booming was, of course, Japanese auto exports to the United mm-hmm. States. And now our news tells us that more and more Japanese cars are actually being built here in the United States. Yeah. So does that also sap some energy out of the Japanese economy?
Well, that's part of globalization. That's a natural part of globalization. There are cheaper communication and transportation costs if you build your products in the area where you're actually going to sell them. So it's much cheaper for Japanese companies to be building automobiles in the U.S. if they're going to be selling them in the U.S. Mm-hmm. It just makes economic sense. So that's one way in which the Japanese car companies and all companies can actually be more globally competitive if they're willing to make those changes. But obviously domestic politics comes in and people say, wait, you know, are we hollowing out our economy? Where are the jobs going? And every economy has that type of concern as well.
So in Japan, they're having that debate. They're saying all of our jobs for our cars are going to North America, for instance.
North America is less of a concern than China and Southeast Asia, that many of the jobs are going to cheap labor, that the decision is not purely based on the idea of, well, it's better for us to build the cars or other products where we're going to sell them, but that the labor and other costs are just cheaper.
Mm-hmm. Now, in another economic facet and in terms of economic ties between the U.S. and Japan, there's something that's developing called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Tell us what that is.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, is a regional free trade agreement that has been being negotiated since about 2009. And it currently contains around 12 countries of the Asia-Pacific, including the U.S., and now Japan, very recently, after being invited by the U.S., has announced that it will be interested in joining the TPP and has decided to enter into negotiations with the other countries.
When a country like Japan is considering entering this, it sounds like an AFTA-like relationship for free trade. Yes. How does that partnership, that membership, look from Japan's perspective?
Well, it's very interesting because you have different interests who see the partnership in extremely different ways. So on the one hand, you have those who see this as an opportunity. Japan is the third largest economy in the world. And if there is such an important regional free trade agreement that is being negotiated, it wants to be there at the beginning, so that it can influence the way in which that agreement looks and really have its interests served, as well as opening up, lowering barriers, opening up trade so that it can lead down to success of Abenomics, right? Abenomics is all about global competitiveness. Mm-hmm. Well, the TPP is also focused on more global competitiveness.
Now, this Trans-Pacific Partnership, this free trade agreement like NAFTA, for this region, a number of members, Chile, New Zealand, Singapore, mm-hmm. along with the U.S., Australia, Peru, Vietnam, Malaysia, Mexico, and Japan, the most recent member. I wonder, what is the benefit for the United States in being in this partnership?
There actually are both economic and national security benefits. So the economic benefits go back to what I said about the global competitiveness, that if you are engaging in lowering barriers for your exports, in encouraging free trade, you're going to expand your markets and become more competitive, which will help your economy. There's also a national security perspective, though, and this is that it goes back to Obama's pivot to Asia. The idea that the U.S. wants to be a major player, continue to be a major player in Asia, and not be left behind in any facet mm-hmm. of that advancement. Mm-hmm. We know that the Asia-Pacific is a growing, prospering area, and the U.S. wants to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more about that, the strategic rebalancing. It's been over a year since the Obama administration released its latest national security strategy, calling for this rebalancing of a U.S. strategic focus from the Middle East to the Pacific. What's the thinking behind this strategic shift?
So under the Clinton State Department, there was a clear interest in continuing to be engaged in Asia, but becoming even more of a player in Asia through actions such as the TPP. But also in terms of strengthening our alliances with Japan, with Korea, and with other countries in the Asia Pacific. The idea of rebalancing, and originally was called a pivot, which was very controversial, was really showing a commitment by the Obama administration that it understands how important that region is for the future of the United States and for the future of the world in every aspect, both in terms of national security, international security, global economy, the U.S. economy, and many different needs, interests that the U.S. has around the world.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned earlier, the rise of China has a lot to do with this pivot or rebalancing,
yes.
Right? We're looking, you know, when we look at this region in 10 or 20 years, what are the concerns that the U.S. has about it and the reason for this pivot at this point?
There are significant challenges and concerns, certainly. Rising China is at the top of that list. The uncertainty about what that will look like in the future. Everyone has a book out on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, will China be more assertive, more aggressive? What do China's current actions mean for the future? Will China become even more engaged and in the global economy and therefore become less aggressive and less assertive in terms of its territorial interests, et cetera? We don't know what it will look like. And that is the big question. Theories of international politics always talk about uncertainty as the worst thing that can happen, because that's when war breaks out. When there is great uncertainty, when there is transparency, when there is certainty, when the status quo reigns, you don't have to worry as much about war, about crises that will escalate, get out of control. But with the great uncertainty of the rise of China, we don't know. We don't know what will happen, and that's the biggest concern.
Talking about some aspects of the U.S.-Japan relationship with Mary McCarthy, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at Drake University. She specializes in Japanese foreign policy. Mary, it's been nearly 70 years since the end of World War II, since the United States and allies defeated Imperial Japan. And we remember the island of Okinawa as the site of one of the longest and the bloodiest battles in the mm-hmm. Pacific during the Second World War. After World War II, the U.S. established military bases on the island of Okinawa, and that's been a problem over the intervening decades. Many residents of Okinawa dislike these bases, associate them with accidents, crime, pollution, and we've had recent things in the news, flare-ups there. What's the state of that right now about the feeling of continuing to have military bases on that island?
The issue of Okinawa and military bases is one of the biggest challenges that faces U.S.-Japan relations, because it is an extremely complex one that does not have any easy answers. About 74% of the land that U.S. bases or the U.S. military uses in Japan is in Okinawa, a small collection of islands. What this means is that the Okinawans carry a disproportionate burden of U.S. military in Japan. U.S. military in Japan is essential to the U.S.-Japan alliance, to the role and the position of the U.S. in the Asia Pacific, and yet the feelings of the Okinawan people is extremely understandable. That they feel that they are being used by not only the U.S. military, but their own government, the Japanese government, because you don't see a willingness of the Japanese government to say, well, we'll move some of those bases up to, you know, up to Tokyo, up to other areas.
Right.
Because they like them in that area of Okinawa, and it's been decades, and it's very comfortable in terms of the Japanese government, the U.S. government, to say we'll just leave the bases there.
Mm-hmm. And there's certainly an economic impact there with all the spending of the monies associated with bases.
Oh, certainly. I mean, there are many economic and environmental impacts. You have employment. But those who are against the U.S. bases in Okinawa say, wait, but if we turned into a tourist destination and could have many more Chinese, Southeast Asians, Americans, Europeans coming here and using our beaches and using all this land, beautiful environment that's taken up with U.S. bases, how much more money could we bring in? So that's a counter of, okay, there's employment, but would tourism really help our islands to take off and to prosper? Mm-hmm. So that's one controversy.
Well, in World War II, Okinawa was of strategic importance as an island to capture before the presumed invasion of Japan. What is the strategic importance of Okinawa in the 21st century?
If you speak to the U.S. military, they will tell you that Okinawa is in the geographic position for U.S. bases, and that they have to have U.S. bases on Okinawa if they're going to have a significant presence in Asia. And this is because of the proximity of Okinawa to all potential hotspots. It's in southern Japan, extremely close to Taiwan, extremely close to the Korean Peninsula, in a position where U.S. military could very easily get to any location in Northeast or Southeast Asia. So it's just a situation that the U.S. military feels is ideal in many ways.
Mary McCarthy, Associate Professor of Politics and International Relations at Drake University. Mary, thank you very much for helping us pivot our awareness to Southeast Asia and understand a little bit more about what's going on there with the U.S. relationship. Mary McCarthy, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Here's a question for you before the break. What do Bahrain, the Philippines, New Zealand, Latvia, Ireland, Kuwait, South Korea, Hungary, Panama, Pakistan, Uganda, India, Japan, and China all have in common? The answer? These countries all have writers coming to spend a 10-week residency here in Iowa. When we come back after a short break, I'll be joined by the director of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa, Christopher Merrill. He'll tell us about some of the writers converging on Iowa City in the coming weeks and about the public events you can attend to meet these international writers and explore their writings. He'll also tell us about a free project which explores each of the 52 parts of Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, translated into 12 languages. By the way, if you want to listen to any of the interviews you hear on River to River again, or listen to a conversation you might have missed, simply go to iowapublicradio.org and find River to River. That's where all of our interviews are downloadable as podcasts or available online as streaming audio. A conversation with Christopher Merrill of the International Writing Program when we come back. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, we're going to do a sort of news roundup show we like to do occasionally, catch a number of issues that we haven't talked about on this program. We'll talk about an Iowa Supreme Court decision, meaning that hundreds of Iowans in prison have a chance to apply to get out of prison. Also, we'll talk about how tough we should be on mandatory sentences for minors convicted of severe crimes. And the Iowa Department of Transportation has a new smartphone app aimed at preventing teenagers from texting while driving. That tomorrow, along with a college football preview, our Tuesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And, always you know that autumn is approaching in Iowa when When what? When the corn stalks stretch above our heads, when the Iowa State Fair in Des Moines closes its gates, and when the University of Iowa prepares to host writers from around the world as part of its 10-week residency program. Since 1967, over 1,400 writers from more than 140 countries have been in residence at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. And this residency is designed for established and emerging creative writers of all kinds, poets, fiction writers, dramatists, nonfiction writers. Joining me to tell us about the latest set of established writers, international writers converging on Iowa City in the coming weeks, Christopher Merrill, poet, essayist, writer, and director of the University of Iowa's International Writing Program. Chris Merrill, welcome back.
Nice to be back, Ben.
When last we spoke, we want to talk about the writers you have coming here, but when last we spoke, many of our listeners will remember you had just returned from Turkey, from Iraq, from Abu Dhabi, and we're about to leave for Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. Tell us, how's your summer been, and how did those visits go?
Well, it's an unusual travel itinerary for the summer, but it was in the service of cultural diplomacy, and we had a really terrific trip, especially to Turkmenistan, which is, after North Korea, the most repressive regime on the planet. We brought with us a writer named Stephen Kuzisto, who some of your listeners will remember from
his time
here.
We have talked to him on this program, wonderful man.
Wonderful poet and memoirist and advocate for disability studies. And for the first time, we managed to reach out to the disabled community. Steve is a remarkable speaker and a very funny man. And in our last event in Ashgabat, in the capital of Turkmenistan, we met with disabled sportsmen and who were trying to write. And I have to say it was one of the most moving experiences in my life, watching Steve interact with these people who one of whom had just won a beauty contest, others of whom were weightlifters, people who were making their lives testify in really interesting ways. And it was wonderful for us to have a chance to connect in a different way. We are always trying to connect as writer to writer, writer to readers and translators and students. But in this case, we've widened the envelope, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And I understand you just days ago you returned from China.
I was in Western China for a poetry festival at Lake Qinghai on the Tibetan Highlands. I was with poets from 48 other countries, and we were outnumbered by Chinese poets 3-1. And we got to see a variety of landscapes and to hear poets speaking in many different languages.
Now, when you have a poetry festival like that in so many different languages, how does that work when you have, what did you say, 48 languages? Yeah. Poetry? Are they all translated? What happens? Do you listen to it in the native language?
Well, it works better or worse depending on the level of organization. And what I found is that in China, many things are very well organized at the federal level, but at the provincial level, not so much. So I heard a lot of things in a lot of languages, and I have no idea what they were talking about.
Let's talk a little bit about the upcoming 2013 residency. You have writers I see coming listed on the website. People can send their favorite browser to the International Writing Program, the University of Iowa. They will find the latest on it. I see the Philippines, New Zealand, Latvia, South Korea, Hungary, Panama, Pakistan, Uganda, India, Japan, China. A lot of them, and I'm sure I haven't named perhaps the half of them, because how many writers from how many countries do you have coming this year?
Well, it looks now we'll have 34 writers from 31 or 32 countries. These are, as you mentioned in your rollout, early to mid-career writers, most of whom have achieved not only national acclaim but also international acclaim. They write in every possible genre. They come from every possible continent except Antarctica. Someday we'll get a penguin here or two. And what they bring to what we call the United Nations of Writers is just a diversity of viewpoints. It gives us a chance to see how really big and strange the world is on the one hand, and on the other hand, how much we have in common with writers from so many lands.
Mm-hmm. Over 30 writers coming. We can't possibly get to know all of them in the few minutes that we have here, but tell us about a few of them. Tell us.
Well, one writer we're very excited about is the Chinese novelist A Lei, who is Tibetan-born. His first novel, Red Poppies, was quite a hit in China. It's been translated into English. Many of his works have been made into films. So we have high hopes that he's going to be adding a different note to our conversations. We have a long history of bringing wonderful Chinese writers, including the last Nobel laureate, Mo Yan. This is the first time that we have a Tibetan Chinese writer who will, I think, add new insight into those complicated relations between China and the Tibetan Autonomous Province. We have our first writer from Yemen, a poet and a filmmaker. We have writers from Bahrain, from Egypt, which is much in the news these days. And so what happens year after year is that wherever news is happening around the world, we generally have a writer from there who can give us the inside scoop about what's really going on. We look at Egypt and we can't make sense of all the different changes, the military takeover, the news today of all the prisoners dying in custody. I'm anxious to hear what our fiction writer coming from Egypt will have to tell us about what's happening on the street even as we speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, we hope to have a few of your writers in the coming weeks on this very program to talk about some of the hot spots in the world as they develop in our news. Now, the International Writing Program is residency also provides what time for these writers? It's in having talked with a number of these writers over the year, they prize this sort of island they get to go to in the middle of the United States called Iowa.
Yeah.
It's an island not only where they have time, but they're put in contact perhaps for the first time with a large number of writers, but then a large number of cultures and languages. Is that what makes this program unique?
Well, it is the fact that it's Iowa. It's the UNESCO City of Literature. So they come to a place where we take writing really seriously. There aren't that many distractions as there might be in New York City or in San Francisco, so they can get work done. I say to them on the first day that I hope that by the end of their stay, they will have written many new pages, they will have experienced many new things and have many new friends. But really what I'm hoping for is that in the conversations they have across borders with writers from so many different lands, they're going to come away with a bigger picture of what it might be to be not only a writer but a citizen of the world.
Mm-hmm. Some of these writers have been to the U.S. before, are fairly acquainted with our country. Others, it's a first-time visit, isn't it?
Mostly the writers have had little contact with little time in the United States. We prefer to get writers who haven't had that chance yet so that they will experience everything anew. You know, we get a little bit sometimes we get writers who've been on many different residencies and for whom it feels like one more thing to add to their CV. That's not the writer we're looking for. We're looking for a writer who wants to engage other writers, wants to be a part of the community, wants to be open to new experience.
Mm-hmm. So there's not only something here for the writers who attend the residency, but there's quite a bit here for us Iowans.
Oh, we have so many public events. If you go to our website, it averages something like two public events a day. We have readings at Prairie Lights Bookstore every Sunday. We have readings at the Shambaugh House every Friday. We have a Global Express, an evening of staged readings. We show films every Wednesday night in a series called Cinematheque, where the writers introduce films from their homeland. There are panels. This year we have the Iowa City Book Fair, where our writers will be featured on a number of panels.
Christopher Merrill is my guest this half hour. He's director of the University of Iowa International Writing Program, giving us a preview of the 2013 residency when over 30 writers will be coming from all parts of the globe to spend 10 weeks in Iowa doing various things, also interacting with us here in Iowa. It's interesting, too, because it's such a unique opportunity for anyone really to attend any of the events that you have, but also to speak with writers who come from countries where free speech is not protected. And you've had many of those over the years. Did any of those fall into that category this year?
Well, we have a long tradition of bringing writers first in the days of the Cold War from the Soviet bloc. This was a place where there could be a free and frank exchange of views with writers from the West and from other countries. More recently, we find writers coming from China, from different parts of the Middle East. We have a writer coming from Iran this year. these are writers who have more or less access to free speech. We've had writers from Uzbekistan. I saw a list of the 20 most repressive regimes in the world, and I went down that list and I thought, wow, we've had writers from most of them. We have yet to get a writer from North Korea, but that's only a matter of time.
When you go to Uzbekistan, and you're just back from Uzbekistan, how do you establish contact so that you're allowed to travel to some of the most repressive countries in the world and open up these corridors of cultural diplomacy?
Well, a good part of our program is funded by the U.S. State Department through the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, and we work with embassies in different countries, and it's always a dance. I went to Uzbekistan a year ago to see if we could try to get some things going, and the fact is I didn't get a visa approved until 2 hours before my plane was to take off. I made it there. I wasn't allowed to do any sort of official activities, but somehow or other, the opening that we established on that first trip made possible this follow-up tour where I was able to bring three other American writers. We were greeted enthusiastically at universities, at literary centers, at schools. And so you're just taking it step by step. You're trying to find common ground. You're trying to meet in the arena of culture, not of politics. There may be huge political differences between the countries that we work with. But we're hoping that by addressing literary issues, we can find the ways in which we can meet rather than to disagree.
Speaking of these repressive regimes, one might ask, what is in it for them? Why do they want to foster contact with the cultural side of the U.S., which they may condemn in various ways? Why do they want contact with Christopher Merrill of the University of Iowa International Writing Program?
It's a good question. the fact is that they have a different government will have its own ideas about why it wants to host writers from America or not. It may feel that this is a safe place where conversations can take place. They may feel that their young people need to have some access to the glories of American higher education in addition to some of our better writers. Every government will have its own motives, but we're hoping that always we can meet on the field of culture.
Let's talk about a few of the aspects connected with the International Writing Program, some things, some spokes, some offshoots that you have going here that I find very interesting. There's something called the Whitman Web, a free project exploring each of the 52 parts of Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, translated into 12 languages. Tell us about this.
Well, this comes again out of that whole idea of cultural diplomacy. We have no we have no diplomatic relations with Iran. In fact, we are often, it seems, on the verge of war with them. So there is a virtual embassy has been created, which can introduce American culture to the Iranian population. We were invited to put together something on in terms of literature, to introduce an Iranian audience to American literature. So I thought, Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, foundational text, it's really the great hymn to democracy. I thought, well, what if we looked at it week by week for a year? It happens to be in 52 parts. That breaks down to once a week. So once a week, my colleague Ed Folsom, who co-founded the Whitman Archive, writes an introduction to a section. I write a commentary. We pose a question. We have the poem translated into Iranian, into Farsi, into Chinese, into Russian, two different versions in Arabic. We even have a version now in Malay. So what we're doing is we're introducing this great hymn to democracy, to individualism, to the self, to America. We're introducing it through a variety of translations to the rest of the world. And we've had a pretty lively conversation, especially on Facebook. Iranian readers they quarrel with this or that, but they are engaging with a signal American literary text.
Does the government observe this virtual meeting around Walt Whitman's work?
I think it's safe to say that what we're doing is being monitored, but so far it hasn't been shut down, and we hope it will continue.
Another project connected with the International Writing Program, Same Gate Film, a documentary that has to do with a gathering in in Turkey.
Yeah, well, this comes out of the first trip that I made to Iran some years ago, hoping to see what sorts of cultural diplomacy, what kinds of connections we might be able to foster. And what we came up with was, let's see if we could bring together in Konya, Turkey, where the shrine to the great poet Rumi, the great Sufi poet, is. We thought, what if we brought together poets and writers from America, Afghanistan, Iran, Pakistan, Syria, Turkey, and just see what might happen. And what we did was we met. We had very intense conversations. We had both Iranian professors and Iranian exiles who were wary of one another. We had an Afghan delegation that was wary of one another. We had Americans trying to sort out what was going on. Each of these countries that we were meeting with, they claim Rumi as their national poet. And so we were having these discussions about Rumi as the great religious poet, as the poet of women, what his relationship is to other men, how does this all shake out? And the idea was that we would make a book out of this and make a film out of this. And our filmmaker was a wonderful Armenian filmmaker born in Aleppo, Syria, educated at UCLA, living in Beirut. I mean, who, as it happened, was able to speak Turkish better than anybody except the Turkish writers. And so he was always ordering for us at restaurants. And it was a wonderful international melange of people trying to see what kinds of common ground we could find.
Is this documentary film accessible by
it will be the book is almost finished and the film is almost finished. Sometime later in the fall, we'll be releasing both, and they'll be available on our website.
Let's talk about a new fellow that the IWP has, the International Writing Program, has a new public outreach fellow. And her name in this case is Patricia Portella. What is this position and specifically this person going to be doing?
This is one of the fellowships funded by the State Department, and the idea is to find a writer who will engage with the local community on a regular basis. Patricia Portella is a well-known playwright and fiction writer. She's coordinated a lot of stage performances all across Europe and the Middle East, China, and Brazil. And we hope that what she's going to do during her time here, she'll have a weekly blog about her engagement with the Iowa City community, but she's also going to do an installation piece, and she's going to work with local artists to create something by the end of the fall semester. We don't know what it's going to be yet. She's going to get here in a few days, and she will be kind of sniffing things out and see what works best for her, but we're hoping that that engagement will prove to be a good model for future fellowships.
In April of 2012, President Obama appointed you to the National Council on the Humanities. And I know over the years you've conducted these cultural diplomacy missions in well over 30 countries in the for the U.S. State Department, including Egypt, other Arab countries, also within the last year. I'm wondering, you mentioned earlier the turmoil in Egypt, the deaths in Egypt. I have to ask the role of cultural diplomacy when there are so many deaths, so much turmoil. Mm-hmm. We could have a reconciliation there. We could have civil war. We could have a military dictatorship. How do you see your role in such tragic times for Egypt?
Well, Egypt is a particularly complicated case. I think that at the moment, nobody really knows what's going to happen. And from a cultural diplomacy perspective, we don't really know what to do. So when faced with an immediate crisis like this, there's really not much you can do from a cultural diplomacy perspective except to hang back and watch and see what kinds of openings there might be. The interesting thing is that ever since the Arab uprising in the winter of 2011, we keep trying to make something happen to see what kinds of programs we might do in Egypt, and things keep blowing up. And so we end up going to other parts of the region. We've done work in Bahrain. We're putting together something in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. But in each case, we're biding our time and trying to figure out what might be the best place to do something. And always what we're trying to do is to introduce something about teaching about creative writing, the mm-hmm. ways in which we do this in the United States, and with the hope that we'll have a conversation with writers who have their own ways of serving a literary apprenticeship and mm-hmm. then seeing what kinds of connections might be forged.
It's also about sort of recognizing that, you know, wars and conflicts are always built on making the other appear so different than you.
Yeah.
And cultural diplomacy brings together all these commonalities when we remove the language barriers and so forth, doesn't it?
The thing I've always loved about the IWP is having in residence at the same time almost always an Israeli and a Palestinian. And inevitably, they argue and they will never agree on political matters, but they almost always find themselves in complete agreement about food, about music, and about what makes for a good poem or a good story.
So speaking of food, what aspects of Iowa food do you introduce your writers to from around the world? I don't suppose they all eat corn off the cob, do they?
Well, we insist that they try some corn while they're here. It is, you know, when I was hired here 13 years ago, David Skorton said to me that I wasn't coming for the seafood or the nightlife. But I like to say the nightlife is entirely literary and the seafood has gotten really good. So we think they'll be happy.
Chris Merrill, director of the University of Iowa International Writing Program, thanks for coming by. And remind us again, how can people find out more about this residency? And see how they can take part and see some of these events.
Go to the IWP website, iwp.uiowa.edu, and click on the writer's biographies, calendars. It's all there.
Chris Merrill, thank you so much for coming into our studio once again today.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Des Moines, we had help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.